Dr. McLuhan asked you to write something, 25 words, on what meaning means?
No more than 25.
No more than 25. Would you shoot them out to the end of the aisle and we'll grab them a little later? Or somebody, would you start again? Yeah, Paul, all right, you go. Marshall, do you want to, should we do what we were talking about doing and talking about the medium as the message and some examples thereof?
Well, as another approach to the formal examination on understanding media, we haven't set a date for that, but we will shortly. I thought we'd devote today to medium as the message and the meaning of that. And there happens to be a very handy approach to that in a new book called Culture, edited by an anthropologist, Ashley Montague, well known to Professor Carpenter and myself, and he lives nearby here too. But first I might point out that the title, The Medium is the Massage, is a pun on several levels, including hyphen, mass, age. The electric age is a mass age because all electric media are instantaneous, and therefore the individual and the group cease to have their old outlines or characteristics at all. Under electric media, just have a world tribe, probably to be ruled eventually by Pat Paulson. But the medium is the massage means also that every medium of whatever kind, speech or match or cigarette, a cigarette is a weak form of pot or LSD, a little inner trip for the people who like very quiet ones. Smoking is inner trip. The Indians, all native societies, indulge in this as an inner trip. It's never been studied in our society as an inner trip. But the pipe is more obviously an inner trip than the cigar or the cigarette. But every medium creates an environment, and that is always invisible. You name it, any medium, whatever, creates a new environment which is invisible. And it is this medium, the hidden one, that is the message in all cases. The message of all technologies is the environment that it creates. And we will talk about that during this coming hour, because it's a fascinating subject. It's fascinating simply because the new environments are always unnoticed by the people who live in them and who make them. That's just as true now as it was in pre-literate tribal society. The example that we were going to discuss in this culture book is a very simple one, and it's one that will interest all of us very much, and Professor Carpenter is in an excellent position to do a critique of many of the assumptions behind some of these anthropological hypotheses. But I heard Father Culkin trying to...
No, go ahead.
Say something.
No, it's all right. Go
No, no, there isn't any great rush here at all. The nothing of any value was ever done in a hurry. But the passage that is on page 31 here in this book called Culture by Ashley Montague, and I'll just read you a word or two, because the approach that these writers in this chapter take to the development of media in primitive conditions is the approach that I personally use in dealing with a railway or with a radio or with a computer. The passage concerns the presumed development of a habit in primitive society of what they call carrying. The trick that made survival possible for some of these societies was the trick of carrying. I'm skipping a bit. What they carried were sticks and stones to use for dwellings, nests. But once they started carrying, they had to give up walking on all fours. And once they started carrying, they became bipedal. They started to walk. Carrying in the hands meant once they started carrying the hands, they began to walk erect. This changed many, many things. It created memory and foresight, they say, because if you're going to start carrying things, you have to remember what you left behind and what you want to take with you, which requires foresight. It also, once you start using your hands, you need clothing to augment your carrying power. Clothes were first used, apparently, as pockets or means of carrying objects. But when your hands are free, once you start standing up straight and stop swinging through trees by your hands, then your hands are free and you can have tools and other extensions of the hand. The extension of the foot is the wheel. That came much later. But when your hands are free, your mouth and teeth are also free. You don't have to carry things in your mouth anymore. And this enabled people to begin to make strange sounds, calls that suggested help or food or danger. Before speech, they hypothesized man used a call system, which is just along what we call a sort of scream or yowl, and which you hear in operas. Operas are returned to the call system instead of speech. Ordinary music is speech slowed down. Opera is speech slowed down to the point where it ceases to be speech. It just becomes a howl, or a wild cry of lament, or fear, or pain, which we call grand opera. The folk song is not quite so primitive as grand opera. It still, like Peter Seeger, sticks with speech slowed down. But now, from the habit of carrying, think of the changes in the human senses resulting in all these new extensions, including speech. When the mouth is free, these people say, man was free to chatter. He could make yakety-yak the way gibbons and monkeys do at the present time. Now, every time, one thing these people do not pay any attention to is what senses are involved in these changes. In carrying, what sense is involved? Not tactile so much as kinetic. The upright position puts man in a much more intimate relation to gravity and compels him to see the world in a totally different way. In fact, it compels him to use his eyes for the first time. The effects of using one's eyes in an upright position are fantastically complicated, including the fact that we see upside down. All the lenses of all eyes are adjusted so that every object is presented to your attention upside down. Mentally, you correct that, you turn it right side up. Everyone does that. Nobody knows why. No anthropologist, no oculist, nobody knows why we turn our imagery upside down. We see it upside down and we turn it right side up. When you're in a space capsule, there is no upside down. You can't see anything, so you don't turn anything right side up. There's an even more fascinating example of this in Eskimo art, which I'll have Professor Carpenter comment on.
Well, as far as we know, verticality, in the sense that you and I perceive things rendered in a vertical fashion, this comes primarily with writing, and that young children don't have it, natives don't have it, and people who cast off the burdens of literacy in our society, the mentally ill, will often abandon it. And they're able to proceed without difficulty from almost any direction. Now, I suspect that there is some tendency toward verticality, but it isn't the overriding one that we have in our own culture.
Well, in the case of representational art, or in the case of movie images, you expect it to be right side up. It's obvious that in action painting, and most of the painting of our time, there is no right side up. You'd be silly to try to find the right side up of any painting in any modern exhibition. There is no right side up. All angles simultaneously.
We were postulating shortly before this meeting that possibly what quality there is of verticality is the result of the proprioceptive awareness of gravity. That is, your constant awareness of where the earth is in relation to yourself. I was wondering what Dr. Carpenter would say about that. Is that a possibility?
It's one of the habits of very learned people is that when they don't know anything, they just don't mention it. Coleridge made a very handy observation 100 and some years ago. He said, always start with the other man's ignorance. You can quickly then acquire his knowledge. In dealing with any problem, any situation, start with the other man's ignorance, not with what he knows. Because what he knows would take you just as long to acquire as it took him. So you start with what he doesn't know. Now, for example, this matter of the invisible environment. The authors of this very learned passage do not know that every technology creates a new environment that is invisible to the users thereof. Once you know that, and this is a very recent book and by the most learned man in this field, once you know their ignorance, you can quickly acquire their knowledge. The new environment, carrying, for example, this obviously creates a new environment. So does speech. Once you can speak and use signs that are not representational of anything present, but of things long past or things far away, then you have command over time and space that is fantastic. Speech as communication gives you a huge time, space, power. We call it tradition. Collective memory. The subconscious is made up of speech, memories from many human pasts, many tribal pasts. So the extensions of man, in this sense, create environments of many, many dimensions all of which tend to be concealed from us. In the electric age, however, we have access to all pasts and all times and all speeches and all languages at such speed that the pattern of them becomes very plain and simple. The reason that the electric age has characteristics unknown to any previous human age is this speed of access to all previous knowledge and all previous human experience. The effects of such speed on human consciousness or on the conduct of human life in the present and the future is almost beyond imagination. In other words, the speed itself creates a new environment that we are completely unaware of. The NASA teams are completely unaware of the new electric environments created by speed. They still think they're dealing with space, outer space, 200 years out of date. Our most advanced scientists are 200 years out of phase and don't know it. There's nothing new about this. There's always that sort of gap in human awareness has always existed. But in our time, it becomes possible to close these gaps if we wish. Now, I opened a book the other day that I've known as a classic for many years, The Virginian by Owen Wister, the first of the Westerns, on which all Western books and films have been based ever since. First page deals with the railway. The railway created the Wild West, created the frontier, where people from all sorts of civilizations could suddenly appear in the midst of nowhere. When you appear in a new environment, you are nobody. How do you establish an identity in a new environment like the Wild West? How do you let people know who you are when there isn't any neighborhood and there isn't any society and there isn't anybody who knows anybody? Well, you know how they do it. Violence, toughness, accuracy, speed, power, strength. And this is what happens in any slum. In a slum, you're just like the Wild West. Nobody has any identity. There is no neighborhood, just misery. How do you establish an identity in a slum? Worth looking into. And the problem in our world today, the new environment of speed up, of instantaneous speed up, creates problems for every one of us. And I suggest as a project for all of you that you begin to make an inventory, careful observations of your younger brothers and sisters, 13 and under, to notice the change in life patterns, lifestyles, from your own. If you have brothers and sisters who are 13 or younger, you will quickly discover that they do not use your way of looking at the world. They do not accept your assumptions about daily life or education. And you're in a position to do top-level, first-hand research that has never been done in the world today in your own homes. One of the things that immediately happens in an instantaneous environment of information is that nobody can have a goal anymore. It's impossible to have a goal when you have all times and all spaces simultaneously present. You cannot have an objective in life anymore. You cannot have a fixed position because you're everywhere at once, in all ages, in all times, at once. How can you have a point of view? Impossible. That's why you can't have an upside down in modern art. There's no point of view.
Could you explain to me by
a point of view depends upon a fixed position, on situations remaining absolutely steady for long periods of time. like the Victorian age. However, in the Victorian age, they were having a lot of technological revolutions, such as the railway and the steamship. And the railway broke up human homes and happiness at a ferocious rate. Anybody could walk a mile or half a mile to a station, buy a ticket, and never be seen again. Yeah. You can't have a point of view on the war in Vietnam because you're living it, and you are as much a part of that war as anybody in the war.
Well, what would a point of view mean, Marshall, here? Maybe that's...
it just means having an opinion. Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think everybody here has an opinion on the war in Vietnam.
Well, then you're just irrelevant and immaterial to the present occasion. But you can see that you can't have war under these conditions. That's nothing to do with Vietnam. It's just simply that under instantaneous speed, you cannot have war at all. When you're totally involved, like an action painter? No, but when you're totally involved in a situation like a bathtub, what's the point of view of anybody up to his neck in water? What's the point of view of somebody immersed, totally immersed in water, shaving underwater? Yeah, as in the good advertisements. There's no point of view possible. When you're totally involved in any situation, you have no point of view. You have to have detachment. You have to be outside the situation to have a point of view. You're getting your identity. You're discovering who you are very fast, and your limitations are being assigned to you very rapidly as you get beaten up. You quickly discover just who you are and what you lack in this world. This is the main form of achieving identity, getting beaten up or beating somebody else up. That's what we call the educational system. The educational system is a form of warfare conducted against your nervous system, trying to shape it and pattern it into patterns which we approve of and which you have never heard of. No, because you're too involved. You're blinded. You can be blinded by rage. You can be blinded by any passion at all. So you have no point of view when under the influence of drink, let alone LSD. A point of view is a technical term. It means a fixed perspective on a steady object. When the object is moving, no point of view possible. Oh, well, now, you're falling into colloquial speech. Point of view is a technical term. It's not colloquial. Yes, sir. The media completely massage you, yes. And they've done a very complete job on you. This is a very old-fashioned situation. A classroom is a very old-fashioned situation. It's 19th century. A lecture is a 19th century situation. It's not 20th. You know everything about media in the sense that you have been completely massaged by them, but you have never had any detachment. You've never had a look at them. This is what we're trying to do. We take you back to a 19th century situation in order to have detachment enough to look at them.
Is it the electric circus or the cheetah where it costs you $5 to go in, but it'll only cost you $4 if you take your shoes off? Circus, yeah. Again, because they found that people with shoes on are sort of out of it. You know, they come in as tourists and observers and not participants as much as... The best thing you can do to establish communication with people is all do something stupid together, you know, that kind of theory of things. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
We speak of getting with it, which means merging into the situation and abandoning all private action. in this age, involvement and getting with it means accepting the total environment as a service environment and giving up all action. Yes, any group of people who are somnambulists, there's no point in talking about free will, is there? Sleepwalkers, people who are moving around in worlds unperceived, have no free will? Of course not. Free will is based upon the assumption of consciousness and alertness, awareness. We're trying to build up awareness here by shocking, just by shock, by sort of punching you on the nose intellectually, to introduce you to the principle of identity and awareness and point of view, if you like. But it takes an awful lot of shock to get people out of the somnambulistic trance created by electronic environment. The electronic environment is total. It massages every pore, every faculty you possess. It creates a service environment that puts you thoroughly to sleep. People talk about the death of God, for heaven's sake. They've never wakened up to any existence, let alone the existence of God. This is an amplification of point of view. A microphone simply amplifies a point of view, like a printed book. A printed book, by ditto, amplifies a point of view. Yes, if I didn't have the microphone, you'd have a seminar. Small, 10 people. That's quite possible. Oh, well, technologically, in a movie, when you watch a movie, you go back through many centuries. You can go to all sorts of countries and places and technologies that you've never seen. Let's ask Father Kalkin if a point of view is possible while you're watching a movie.
Probably not. This is I think. Let me just use some of the experiences I've had with film, as I don't know whether it really illumines it. I remember Sidney Lumet, who did The Pawnbroker and films like that. I remember we had him give a talk for us, and somebody asked him who his favorite director was and all that. Well, he thinks Jules and Jim is just the greatest thing that ever happened, and that Truffaut is the guy he looks to for a lot of guidance. And somebody said, well, what do you do when you go to the movies? I mean, it must be awful. It must ruin films for you to sit there and sort of be looking for what Truffaut did when he made the film. He said, when I watch the movie, the only thing that I can do and the only thing I can hope an audience does is just let it happen, you know, that sort of willing suspension of disbelief or whatever the thing is. The phrase he used is, I just let the movie wash over me the first time I see it. But after seeing it, then he goes into some kind of a post thing. Now, it's sort of interesting. Film is a medium which is paced at somebody else's sense of rhythm. So when Fellini's picture gets on the screen, you can see that in the war, the media war that we've had on the wall over here, the chalk-oriented people have got us to shorten our skirts a little bit on the screen there. But if we had a film up on the screen here, and the projector doesn't break down as it always does, the rhythm and pace and flow of the image is Fellini's. And all you can do, you can't really stop it. You have no control over the flow of those images. You can try to disengage yourself for a while. But if you're going to have the movie experience, the only thing you can do is kind of let down your analytic skills for a while and let this movie hit you on the eyeballs and the ears. But afterwards, and I think this is somewhat interesting, as many of you know have engaged in film discussions, a discussion that you might have the following day of the film reintroduces, you know, your point of view and things like that. Now, that's a weak analogy, perhaps, and I'm not sure that it exactly hits on the nose what you're talking about here. But I think there is something to the fact that the best way to people who are uptight and refuse to give themselves to an experience, who stand back and just analyze instead of experiencing, never really have the experience. But at the same time, I don't think anybody is saved enormously just by giving themselves over to an experience completely and not it.
Last night on the Smothers Brothers, remember Pat Paulson was asked if he were going to run for president. And he said, no. Didn't you once on an ABC program say you were going to run for president? No. So they said, well, wait and watch this. So they played an ABC program in which he definitely announced he was going to run for president. And they said, well, what do you got to say to that? He said, I've been misquoted. That's a media joke, and I hope you're collecting an awful lot of them.
Yeah.
It seems to me that, I don't know, the principle that I would like to operate on is that what we try to do is analyze the things that are happening to us and get some perspective. For instance, now, I mean, the thing on print, on the fact that literacy itself and the printed page impose certain habits of perception on people, which we are now able to observe by comparing them cross-culture, and we can compare because we've got more media than print. But while print was around, nobody was saying that print is causing in people this linear sequential habit of thought. Now, by being able to analyze something which was happening unnoticed, then you get some understanding and control of it.
In business firms, they call in people from outside called consultants to tell them, what is our business? The first question any consultant asks any firm that he enters is, what do you think is your business? And he always hears strange answers because anybody engaged in a business has very little idea of what the business is. He's so enmeshed, he's so immersed. The drop-in, not the drop-out, but the drop-in, the consultant, can tell him what his business is when he hasn't a clue. And in our age, the consulting business has become the biggest at all. It's part of the education of every executive. But in businesses, the people most intimately involved are completely unaware of the nature of the business they're engaged in, until some outsider comes in and tells them what it is. Can anybody? Well, there's only the only form of detachment that I have discovered is to follow the processes. Instead of having a point of view, just take whatever is happening and see where it starts, how it flowers and develops and what it bangs into and what it shapes and just what happens to it. The garbage strike will do as well as any other example of a breakdown that is a breakthrough. The process of garbage collecting is broken down. It isn't just a point of view of a union or of the city. The process has broken down. Technologically, this is a breakdown and also a breakthrough. Every breakdown in any field, as in education today, is a breakthrough in disguise. Therefore, very exciting. I want you to collect all the breakthroughs you can in business or in education, because those are sheer potential of new possibilities. You're saying that this has heightened our appreciation of the system. That we appreciate when something breaks down, then we, like a flat tire or something, we appreciate the pneumatic tire for what it is. But when you say a system, how much of the system? Because the garbage collecting is only a tiny little fragment of the system that produces the breakdown. Garbage is not something that you can isolate from living. Living produces garbage automatically. But when there are great many more and more people living closer and closer together, the nature of garbage takes on new dimensions. What we call garbage today is mostly wrapping paper, old cans and bottles. Nothing to do with garbage. But our new technologies of wrapping and packaging have created a garbage crisis. And nobody, they're still less listed under the word garbage, which has nothing to do with the situation at all. Well, maybe the Container Corporations of America and the Packaging Corporations of America ought to pay for garbage removal. They certainly produce the crisis. Why should the city pay for it? The city doesn't make anything out of garbage. All the container corporations do.
Where do all the beer cans go, you know? Yeah, what?
Private existence. There's very little private consciousness left in the electric age.
But what you're saying, and I think the crux of this whole matter, that we here are becoming aware that there is no point of view, what we are substituting for a point of view is awareness.
Awareness is not a point of view.
That's right, it's a bigger, better thing.
Let me tell you a true story, speaking of awareness. I heard this just yesterday. A friend had a frightful series of, collapses, fits, every sort of neurological misery. And he spent 10 days in the Neurological Institute, and they couldn't find a thing wrong. When he was discharged, he happened to drop by his oculist to have his glasses examined, and the oculist gasped, practically screamed, and he said, "I put the lenses in wrong." He put the wrong lens in the wrong socket. So this was causing all his fits and all his miseries, and headaches and so on. And so he rushed back to the neurological hospital, Columbia Presbyterian, and said, "What about that? Why didn't you notice that?" They said, "You're lucky. Sometimes we take out the wrong eye." Talk about breakdown as breakthrough and point of view. What point of view would you have on this one?
There was an interesting, I think at the New York Film Festival 2 years ago, Tony Shalhoub was talking about it. They had a movie called Flicker. Anybody see that? And all it consisted of was a lot of loud music, loud sounds and music, and then a kind of strobe effect projected on the screen. So I just had this strobe thing going on and no images or anything like that. And, you know, the first 50 people pounded their feet and walked out saying things to themselves. And then gradually a couple of people got up and saw themselves, saw the light playing on them, reflected off the screen, and saw the get interesting effects. Have you ever walked, you know, in that strobe sort of thing? It's like stop action camera. And so gradually they got up and they started interacting with one another and walking out in the aisles and just became kind of the hit of the thing. That had created a new type of environment by using an effect, you know, which is somebody would say, well, there's no movie there, there's nothing happening, but by interacting with that kind of medium, something happens. We had a great example of this type of thing over the weekend. We did a film conference in Washington, and Frank and Eleanor Perry, who were there, have done David and Lisa, have done these Capote stories for television, Christmas Memory and Along the Paths of Eden, and they have one more called Miriam. And they had 150 minutes worth of film, which they're going to cut down to 100 minutes for a theatrical release. So Frank brought his work print down with him, sort of where the film is now. And most of the people in the audience had seen Christmas Memory in total or Paths of Eden. So we had 500 people editing the film with the director. And it added such a dimension of involvement. We weren't physically editing it. Dr. McLuhan suggested this morning that it'd be interesting, and I think maybe we could arrange for it, to bring somebody in with all the material that they've taken. I was thinking of doing it with a one-minute commercial and have somebody bring in the 30 or 25 minutes of shooting that he did and he has to get it down to 1 minute. And the sense of involvement here, the Perrys are very good performers, and they've always turned on audiences. But this was something special because everybody in the audience figured that something they said or interpreted might actually influence something which was still not complete. But
there's a further footnote on what you do see when in the invisible environment created by a new medium. What you do see is the old environment. That which is very visible or very noticeable in a new environment or a new medium is the old one. What we now notice is film in the TV environment. TV we do not notice. It's part of the new environment. Writing with light on the audience. It's X-ray. But what you see on TV, what you think you see on TV is movies. The old environment. And what you saw in movies were the old novel, the old narratives, the old forms, the old photography. In any new medium, you see the old one.
Go.
And naturally, with speed up, for a ballot box is a means of creating images of people that you wanted to have around as governors. It was a technology for selecting images that you would accept for government. Under instantaneous conditions like computer, the ballot box is finished. Representational government is as finished as representational art. And you can... Now, this is not a daring speculation. This is a very simple matter of daily observation. Someone asked what replaces it. This is a challenging remark. But it's a breakdown, so it's a breakthrough, so there is an answer. We could find the answer right here in a few minutes, if we had a few minutes to discuss the question. But why not keep that one on the back burner? If the ballot box is no longer capable of selecting imagery for government, what next? I think you should ask yourselves that question very much. And the Smothers Brothers, incidentally, are asking that question on their programs every night.
Is that the reason for the growth of the executive department
in the United States,
growth of experts that aren't voted for?
Consultants, aides, governmental aides. Counselors who are not who don't represent anything except their own specialty. Well, naturally, all government is now in the hands of such experts. They mostly are unaware of each other. They don't have any communication among themselves because they're so specialized. Sorry, I couldn't hear very much of that.
The novel, is the novel out of date?
Oh, the novel as a form ceased to be anything but pop, song, hit parade stuff 50 years ago. When Ulysses was written, the new novel came in, it was a documentary. The whodunit is actually ahead of the old narrative novel, but yes, the narrative form is finished. And so you have complex mythic and symbolic forms taking over from narrative, as in Ulysses. I haven't seen the movie. They say it's rather close to the novel, but I haven't seen it. But Ulysses was the great stock example of the end of the novel. When did the novel begin? 18th century, only 200 years ago. It had a fairly long run, actually, as most forms go.
All the current novelists are very much aware that the form is dead and are simply making some effort to come to terms with that fact. All the guys at this stage know the novel is dead. He doesn't know what quite to do about it, and so he handles it.
There's still a chance of selling it to some old movie company.
Or maybe something newer, you know, the
mythic form. Well, the mythic form is not narrative, is not novel, does not represent anything. It's non-representational.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, well. The end of something is always the beginning of something. Bax, you're all there? Yes, it was just a form of movie. Newsreel. All the stream of consciousness is a kind of movie newsreel. LSD is a kind of TV, writing with light. It's an attempt to imitate chemically what you've all experienced in another medium.
I forget whether we mentioned the two filmmakers from San Francisco came in, I don't know, back in October or sometime, with a film that wasn't very good called The Addict, and we looked at it and then talked with them for a while. And they were talking about some of the new speed or hard drugs that were being used out there. And one of the things which kept happening to a lot of people is that they kept perceiving themselves in machine and computer terms. They had the experience of being a computer.
Physically, we are. Computers, and darn good ones. We're worried lest the new computers beat us to the draw. But all nervous systems are electric and are all based on the computer principle.
But what was happening here wasn't so much of using the analogy of us as computers, but the fact that they had kind of ingested the environment, the television and computer environment, and were perceiving themselves not as being computers in the sense of information retrieval, but as actual machines themselves.
Even the Saturday Evening Post runs jokes. Little child saying to mom, when I grow up, I'm going to be a computer. So by the time it's got to that level, you know that it's pretty old stuff. I have a point of view in this sense. I feel very unhappy about how little it's possible to say to a group so far away and so large on such complicated questions that other people have seldom even thought about. Remember, we're now talking about questions that your elders have never thought about and that the governors of your country have never thought about. I mean literally. You will not find one person in government or in education at the higher levels who has ever thought about the things we're discussing here today. So I hope this gives you some satisfaction. I try to give satisfaction. if not understanding. You should at least get a thrill out of being way ahead. That's the best way to keep up. Why try to keep up when you can be way ahead? Well, how about that?
Yeah, let's all go home on that one.